This is Microphone Check, hip-hop from NPR Music. Quick note at the top of this week's episode. If you like what we're doing here, you might also like what they do at Fresh Air, an interview show hosted by Terry Gross. She talks to actors, directors, comedians, authors, and musicians, including, over the years, Grandmaster Flash, Melly Mel, Ice-T, Queen Latifah, Three Stacks, and Puffy. You can find Fresh Air at npr.org/podcasts.
This is Microphone Check, hip-hop from NPR Music. I'm Franny Kelly.
I'm Ali Shaheed Muhammad.
I'm Himanshu Suri.
Himanshu. What up?
Hello, Ali Shaheed Muhammad. How are you, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing well.
I'm glad to have a guest who is, like, as big a fan of yours as I am. It makes me feel less awkward.
I'm glad to have someone with so many syllables in their name because it makes me feel less awkward as a rapper.
That's what's up, man.
People would be like, how do you say that? I'll be like, three syllables, like Jonathan. Like, y'all got three syllable names too. What's complicated about this?
So what's happening with you? You have a new record coming along.
Yeah. Yeah, it's out there now.
That's such a
freaking relief to just get it out there.
We premiered it today.
How's it feel? Relief. What is the face of relief?
This is it. Looks tired.
Yeah.
Bags under my eyes.
Yeah, it doesn't, I don't know.
I got knots doesn't look in like my back.
It doesn't look like you released a very groundbreaking record.
I didn't. I released a decent record some kids may like. Man, it's just like, you know, I got caught up with the label stuff. I'm used to putting out mixtapes and doing everything myself. Yeah. I changed my relationship from a distribution deal to a label deal. And then, you know, the label wasn't clearing no Indian samples or reggae samples. And they was, you know, just all these producer contracts and stuff. I'm not on a major. And there's no legal team. So basically made the album December 2013. Spent the last 15 months in limbo just trying to get this out. Mm. Labor pains, man. Just trying to get this baby out my belly. Man.
What? Why did it take so long?
That's on the label, man. They didn't basically want to buy beats on the front end, so then certain producers dropped off. I had to have those beats reconstructed, had to go back in the studio and make a couple new songs, and just label politics, man.
Did that process of having to, like, go back and, like, reconstruct the song, did that make the effort better for you in terms of the final product?
Yeah, I feel like in some ways having, you know, I made the album in Bombay in like 3 days. And yeah, and then the songs I made back home, now that I think about it, were Flag Shopping and Patriot Act. And those are the most outright political songs. And I think when I was in India, I was thinking more about my personal life and writing songs about the breakup with my ex, or writing songs about breakup with my band. But when I got back to New York, I was able to make those songs about New York, about, you know, 9/11. And so definitely, like, that, and that's the core of the album too, is not just like heartbreak in the traditional sense, but heartbreak in the socio-political sense. Mm-hmm. So it was frustrating, but I'm glad I got to add those songs to it. Yeah.
So going back and making the record, those songs in Bombay, were you, and going to the title, Eat Pray Thug, which is similar to Eat Pray Love. Mm. Was that your intent in terms of you just saying, going back and thinking about heartbreak and things in your personal life?
Like, with the title, it was, you know, that book, Eat, Pray, Love, is kind of about this white girl and spiritual tourism, right? Which is something I think about in India, also, like, a lot. When I was there, I was in Haridwar, where my dad is from, and then I'd hop in the auto and go to Rishikesh, where, like, all the white people are, because the Beatles went there. So, you know, the album, like, the Eat, Pray, Thug is also about how I'm just as guilty of exotifying India or of Orientalism as a white person is. Like, I freaked out and I went to India on some I'ma find myself type thing. And that's no different than what, you know, Westerners do in India. So it's kind of about the complexity of identity and contradiction, and just that, you know, while I identify with Indian, I'm not Indian. I am American. And So yeah, Eat, Pray, Thug is kind of a play on that, that I'm no less guilty of this than that white woman. So, and then the other thing is Thug is a Hindu, is an Indian word.
Yeah, I was gonna thug ask
comes
you about
from
that.
Thuggy, and Thuggies were these groups of bandits who would go around. They had razor blades in their bandanas, and they just put the bandana on the neck of a British colonial. Like, they would just, like, you know, run up on these groups of traveling British people and just kill them, steal their shit. And I don't think, you know, so somebody's like, look at this guy talking about he's a thug now all of a sudden. It's like, you know, this hipster kid or whatever. And it's not even about, you know, that. It's about the nature of language and where language comes from. And just that, yeah, maybe a reclamation of the word thug in a sense. Mm. Yeah.
That's dope.
Thank you, Franny.
Just did. Yeah, so we premiered the album, and that was, like, a thing that Timotep really wanted to write about was the combination of, he used the word highfalutin, and I didn't want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a combination of, like, in some ways an academic understanding of the world and, like, an everyday understanding of the world without that much thought given to how those things, like, touch each other, which is, I think, just the way that we live now, right? Like, with the internet and everything.
I think I've always enjoyed mixing highbrow and lowbrow.
Yeah.
And even if you look at, like, That's Racist and Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, and all this stuff we were doing, like, on the one level, it's super lowbrow because people, you can slip in a lot of highbrow stuff when you package it in a lowbrow way. So it was about not beating people over the head with racism is bad, George W. Bush is bad, but packaging it, and part of it was, like, you know, laughing to keep from crying in the long tradition of humor in African American poetry. But yeah, I'm a low brow dude stuck in a hi-fi world. Like, I, you know, going to a school like Wesleyan, working on Wall Street, going to Stuyvesant High School, like, I found myself in navigating, like, all these crazy worlds I never thought I would be a part of. But in my core, I'm just still, like, an Indian kid from, you know, Flushing and East Queens. Like, and so not a lot of, you know, I just grew up in this very particular way. And then I was thrown out into the world. And, like, the world keeps responding, so I keep doing it. But that's why I moved back to Long Island with my family, was to just kind of, you know, keep a sense of where I'm from in my head. But, yeah, I'm guilty of some highfalutin. I'll do that.
Whatever, word NPR is fine.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Just hanging out at NPR with Ali Shaheed Muhammad, no big deal. And you, Franny.
Uh-huh. So I wanted to talk about, like, how that relates to comedy and making people laugh and, like, defying expectations or, like, flipping whatever on its head. And this idea of having, like, laughing to keep from crying. Are you trying? Like, are you writing jokes?
I used to when I was, like...
Can we talk about the song Women?
Sure.
That's, like, one of my favorite songs.
Yeah. I freestyled that. I didn't really write it. That's why I can't perform it. I need to, like, sit down and listen to it. Like,
you should perform it. But it's all about the ad-libs anyway.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I said humor is a good tool and kind of to use to kind of slip in some not-so-funny stuff. And I was... You know, humor is a common defense mechanism for chubby kids. So that's, like, what happened with me. I was just, like, trying to get out of fights by making fun of people and using humor as a tool instead of, like, other things. And like I said, a lot of when you're talking about racism and stuff is super heavy. When I'm talking about innocent lives lost from drone attacks, it's super heavy. And so I still want to talk about those things, but I don't want to beat people over the head with it.
It's interesting. You say you don't want to beat people over the head, but when you talk about it, it's so concentrated and it's very heavy. It's not light at all. So.
Yeah, but that's me. Most of the comedians you see are super depressed. You know, like, look at Robin Williams. That's, like, the classic example this year, but there's a long history of comedians with mental health issues, and I probably fall into that. It is heavy, but it's a heavy thing to be constantly thinking about. But when I started going to that liberal arts college, and I was surrounded by, like, white people and old money and, like, you know, New England, like, trust funds and, like, boarding schools, it was just super confusing. It's something I'd never really had come in contact with before. And I started thinking about race like constantly. And then I was armed with the tools to think about and speak about race from that education. So, you know, and that's why That's Racist was like, now when I talk about race, it's about me as an Indian American. Before, when I was talking about race, it was about the discourse of black and white in America and the gray area that is brown, which is Latino and Indian and Middle Eastern, and just kind of, the history of America and race in this, you know, that conversation's always been black and white, literally and figuratively. Women. These chases women.
$100 million. Wait, Mike says this should be a song about women. But then he said he don't know any women. I told him, yo, I know like 7 women. I know women. They like to go swimming. They like to drink tea. They like to think in the cool breeze. From the east on a beach or the west. Yo, women, they the best. Hey, yo, I think women really like diamonds. Yo, I think they don't usually like violence. They like to roll their eyes when I tell them I be rhyming. Broken dreams, yo, broken hymen. I just wanna burn a spliff and eat Thai, man. When I holler at them, they say it's bad timing. They smell great, I think about them real late. They're better than steak or high stakes. Poker. Yo, women, they're loca. They're sometimes Spanish. When it's real late at the club, they vanish. With dudes after I warm them up with great jokes. They're the great hope, they're very dope. Sometimes they like to smoke. Sometimes they drink drinks with the little umbrellas in them. Sometimes women is venom. But sometimes women is like the best flower. Yo, women, yo, they got the power. Yo, women, they like to take showers. And when they let you take them with them, it's really awesome. Women used to watch Dawson's Creek. And they used to watch 90210. They like to watch shows. Some of them don't. They like to read prose. Some of them like to date pros. That's professionals. Others don't. They like to date maybe artists. Some women are bad and some are harmless. Women, you see, they got the harness. And they can harness all this power that they garnish. Women like to watch You Got Mail with Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. Women, you're great on behalf of men. Thanks.
Thank you, women.
I'm glad to be a part of your ranks. If you accept me, women.
What does the face of assimilating look like to you?
I guess me. What do I look like? I don't look relieved, you said earlier. Do I look like the face of assimilation? Assimilation is so complicated, and like I just saw this amazing play called Disgraced by Aya Akhtar. It won like the Pulitzer, and it's about this rich Muslim Pakistani corporate lawyer with his white wife, and she's an artist, and she's, you know, into Muslim art, and he's, you know, changing his name and trying to get ahead at the firm, and you know, so how like assimilation is necessary and important, but I've always appreciated the kind of privacy of ethnic enclaves. I've always liked that, you know, my dad's been here 30 years and his English still isn't good. Like, I like, that's what I like about New York. You don't have to assimilate if you don't want to. And so I kind of jump between the two of those things a lot, you know.
Then how does one deal with, you know, keeping it raw and traditional without assimilating, but then in the times of where war and the effects of war brings about discrimination, oppression, and hatred to a group of people, and like what has happened here in America, and you have people who have come here to not necessarily assimilate, maybe to assimilate, or to be just who they are.
No, you come here to make money. You don't come here to assimilate. And that's kind of thrusted upon you. and it goes hand in hand. If you want to make more money, you might have to assimilate.
Okay, so then for those, absolutely, right. You know, for those who do that and then find themselves at the face of being identified with an enemy that they are not.
Yeah.
And so how, you know, I'm just.
No, that's interesting because as you assimilate, you come in contact more with American and white people, right? If you're just in your community, you're not thinking about the way your community is treated. You're not thinking about, you're just trying to get through the day and you're just trying to put food on the table. It's when you step out of the community that you get to look at it through a lens where you might be able to help the community. But then you're so far out of it, how do you get back in? Like, how am I supposed to talk about how am I supposed to talk about working class Indian immigrants when I'm hopping on airplanes, flying around the world, you know, being highfalutin? So, you know, there's such guilt with me as a human being about that. Like, I feel like a lot of, I don't know if it's working class guilt or what, but yeah, I feel like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Why am I out there like that? Why am I like, you know, how do I just take things back to when they were simple and I was a kid and I was growing up in my community and I didn't, you know, think about these things. But at the same time, in assimilating, I've been able to be a voice for that community, to humanize that community, to let people know we are just like you. And so yeah, it's like, and it's also just like, you know, how much of yourself do you put in the music? Mm. What do you keep for yourself? How much do you open up to your audience, and which things do you keep for yourself? And so it's like, it's a similar thing with like, or being a voice for the community and then talking about things like substance abuse. Like, I don't want to undermine my efforts in the community by, you know, being labeled, but at the same time, in a lot of communities of color, we don't talk about mental health or substance abuse, and I want to be open about these things because they may help that next kid. Mm-hmm. But you know, and for the community though, it's like, we don't talk about those things. Don't put yourself out there like that gets swept under the rug. And I just find, like, in so many of our families, there's this black cloud hanging over the living room where we don't talk about her getting raped or him being an alcoholic, or we don't talk about, you know, your uncle who married a Muslim, or we don't talk about, and the more you don't talk about that, the more you kind of suffocate it. Mm. And some of those things really need room to breathe. But, you know, I don't want to be that one dude. But at the same time, a lot of times I feel like if someone's got to do it, it should be me.
I think you do it very well.
Whoa, thank you.
It's like, you know, the song specifically that sticks in my head is Patriot Act.
Oh, you listen to the record?
Yeah. And,
people are always surprised.
And, I mean, it, out of any songs that I've listened to for our guests, that song prompted the most questions for me. Just that one song had like layers and layers and layers of questions, and it's just it really pushes the limit on the sensitivity of the subject of being Muslim in America, and looking like, you know, whatever you look like, be it Indian or Pakistani or Arab, and having to be persecuted, even though you're not the enemy. And I mean, there was so many questions that made me wonder about how you, obviously you're using your voice through the music, but it's just not necessarily, this question is not just solely for you and how you live your life and manage it, but just, it made me wonder about people who migrate to America to just be here. And I think you sort of answered it by saying people come here to make money and they're not really thinking about the outer dynamic in mm-hmm. the moment. But it made me wonder, how come people who come here, maybe they don't align themselves with the civil rights sort of a...
Oh, great, yeah. And I try to be very vocal about that fact that, first off, I'm whatever, a working class, then middle class Indian kid, that rap is a black art form, and that I am guilty of appropriation, and that it makes me feel very strange. But at the same time, this is the most appropriate medium because I don't want to be performing race or performing. I'm not a clown here to, you know, appease the whites. So it's like, if I wrote a book or if I used a different medium, I feel like the audience inevitably my audience did end up being mostly middle and upper class white kids, but that's also just rap right now. But I chose rap because, you know, I admit I was appropriating a black art form, but it's also a working class art form. And in this country, working class means black.
It's also a generational platform.
Yeah, no, and fine, yeah, generation two. You know, 80s and 90s, like that was what I listened to. But I think it's important to be cognizant of the fact that black art forms have always been stolen, and that especially as Indian and Chinese people are used in this country to keep black and Latino people down with the model minority myth. You know, I can get into it, but basically we weren't really allowed into the country until 65. Between 65 and 75, Americans mostly brought over PhDs and master's candidates from India, maybe 90% PhDs and master's candidates because of the Cold War. We wanted to step up our science program. At that point, their wives and children weren't allowed. 75, they basically allowed their wives and children to come, and that's when my parents and like working class people came here. That's when the cab drivers or the 7-Eleven guys came here. Then around 91, the Indian economy liberalized. And even right now, most of the Indians coming are this H-1B class, which means they're here to be bankers, computer programmers, or, you know, the upper class. So, you know, in the 90s and stuff, we spent so much time being like, we're not just Apu. We're not just, you know, these cab drivers. Look at us. We're doctors. We're engineers. But now everyone just looks at us like doctors and engineers. And so nobody's speaking on behalf of those cab drivers or, you know, the same way white, like Manhattan Indians don't care about Queens Indians. And like, I'll go to India and someone will tell me I'm bridge and tunnel for living in Queens. And I'm like, you took an airplane to come to New York and you're calling me bridge and tunnel? I took a car. Like, how am I less New York than you because you lived in the city for 2 years? So not to get away from your question. So one thing I'm very vocal about, when I lectured at Princeton last year, I was talking about Asian American apathy. That we come here, we make our money, and we don't share that money. We don't put it into philanthropy. We don't help not only our community's working class, but we don't help American communities working class. We're perfectly letting white people say, look, if the Indians can do it, why can't the blacks? Look, if the Indians make this much money, why can't the Latinos? And the answer is because you picked all the smart, rich Indians to begin with. That's cheating. And then more importantly, that law wouldn't have been passed in 65 if it wasn't for the efforts of black people in the civil rights movement. They created the environment that would allow other people of color to come into this country. There's a long history, even before Indians were really allowed, we were jumping ships to come to New York, or we were coming down from Canada and settling in California. And, you know, a lot of the Indians that came here were Muslim around the time the Nation of Islam was popping off. They would have to go to these Bengali restaurants to eat halal food. And there was a lot of interaction between the Indian and Pakistani and Bangladeshi Muslims and the black Muslims. You know, they would have these debates like, you know, the Indians would be like, show me in the Quran where it says white man is devil. You know, like, I don't see that. And, like, you know, these other experiences where, there, you know, if you were a black man who wanted to ride in the white car on the train, you might throw a turban on because Indian people were mysterious and exotic but seen as, you know, rich in gold and spices, whereas our own minorities were seen as, you know, you have to sit in the back of the bus. Mm. So there's a long history, and I feel like now a lot of South Asians forget that. So, you know, when something like Ferguson is happening, these Indian kids are talking about the guy at the bodega where the kid stole the cigars. They're not talking about, you know, getting down there and helping the black community. They're talking about, well, he did push the Indian guy. Well, what the hell does that matter? And part of that is just, it's so rare that an Indian's even, you know, out there in the public, in the news, in pop culture, that we're so deprived of seeing brown people in media that we get excited when we see, the Indian guy at the store where Michael Brown stole the cigars from, he was Indian. That has nothing to do with the narrative. Like, but that's what the South Asians were talking about when that happened. So for me, I'm very vocal about the fact, yeah, that I practice a black art form and that I don't want my community or me to be used to further keep black people and Latino people back. The same way as black bodies in American jails and on an imperial level as brown bodies in American jails around the world or Gitmo. So I see it as one and the same, but at the same time, I'm hesitant to, like, I have had a much easier experience in this country than African Americans have, and I want to be vocal and upfront about that. I've had it a lot easier, and, you know, I think those that have it easier should give back. Does that answer you?
No, it's funny, though, as you ask what the face of assimilation is. I'm the face of assimilation.
How's that?
My family's all mostly Irish and, like, Barbados and Scottish, and, like, people don't know where I'm from, whatever. You can't tell
white girl can like kind of go anywhere at this point, right? But we have, the Irish community has a lot of the same stuff, just like four generations later. And because nobody like had any access to any of this, like we should probably talk about it. The effects are compounded, like, and super pixelated, and people can't figure that shit out. So, I mean,
well, you know what the difference is? That four generations later, Irish, Italian, and Jewish just became white. Whereas Black, Latino, and Indian will never be white.
It's not gonna happen.
So, and I agree, you know. I mean, ultimately, it's not just about race. It's about class. It's about, you know, the world we live in. It's about immigration. And, yeah, the Irish community, the Italian community, the Jewish community have had it extremely tough and contribute so much to New York culture. Like, that's a big part of New York. Assimilation is all of America. I always say white people are the most diverse I ever met. You talk to them, they'll say, like, I'm a quarter Irish. I'm, like, a third, you know, Jewish. I'm Scandinavian. I'm this, I'm that. And I'm just, like, I'm just Indian. So, yeah, assimilation, it's America. We're a country of immigrants, right?
But that's another conversation that happens, like, at my parents' church and in churches, like, I've heard all over the country. It's like people talk about social justice, and it's very frustrating for the younger generation because the older generation wants to save their money and doesn't, and wants to dissociate from, like, rabble and trouble-causing, and, like, they really, really, really don't want to let the women be the priests.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that you have to fight every day, all day.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're a straight white man.
I guess so. I wouldn't even fucking know.
Wow.
Could you explain like 75? Could you explain partition?
Yeah.
Sure.
Same. I had the same question.
India has always been a place where Hindus and Muslims live. There was the Mughal Empire of Muslims, which a lot of people think like wiped out a lot of Hindus. And there was the Emperor Aurangzeb, who people say like, you know, didn't like Hindus and killed them. But then there was emperors like Akbar, who had Hindus in his court and who had a religion that combined parts of Hinduism with Islam. So there was a lot of coexisting. But when my grandparents and my ancestors were in modern day Pakistan, the neighborhood was Muslim, Hindu. The language they spoke had elements of Arabic, Urdu is a Pakistani language, which is basically Hindi with Arabic, and Hindi is an Indian language. But a lot of North India, like I said, there was this interchange between Hindus and Muslims. And what happened is when we started fighting for independence and we got independence in 1947, the British said, we're going to give you your freedom, but we're going to cut the country into two bits. On the east, you're going to have East Pakistan. On the west, you're going to have West Pakistan. And in the middle, you're going to have India. And a lot of the Muslims were fighting to have their own country. But people play up kind of, or it depends on your thoughts on it, but a lot of people say that, you know, the British were in the ears of the Muslim being like, you should get your own country. And a lot of people basically say the idea was to divide and conquer. If we're going to leave this land, we're going to divide it. So y'all will be fighting for the next 100 years while we can sit in Britain counting the gold and spices we stole from you. So when 47 happened, they drew up these borders. And they said, you know, basically, this is going to be a Muslim country. This is going to be a Hindu country. And the Muslim country is going to be divided in the middle by, like, thousands of miles. Eventually, in the 70s, West Pakistan became Bangladesh. As they left, the Hindus who were in Pakistan and Bangladesh had to come to India. And the Muslims who were in India, although a lot of them stayed, a lot of them went to Pakistan and Bangladesh. So what you had was warring religions, you know, riots, rape, murder, just, you know, people compare it to the Holocaust. So my grandparents had to leave everything they had just set up in Pakistan to have the army help them get to India. And, you know, like, along the way, my grandfather had to pretend to be Muslim. My grandmother saw her uncle murdered to death in front of her with sticks. And like I said, there was a lot of rape, a lot of bloodshed. In crossing those borders. And then in 47, my grandparents came to India, and they had their kids in the 50s in India. So I kind of look at it like my grandparents, the big event in their life was partition. My parents, the big event in their life was immigration. And for me, the big event in my life was 9/11, which kind of had to do with the world we live in and the effects in a certain way of like partition or of immigration or of living in a global world. But each thing in a certain way involved, you know, borders, travel, airplanes.
And we're talking like 20 million people?
I don't know displaced. The exact number, but if you, you know, India's a billion people, so it was a very significant portion of the population that was moving. Mm-hmm. Mm. And yeah, people don't know or talk about it.
New York City shit. Grew up in New York in the 90s shit. Like Crown Heights is looking real different and shit these days, no? What's the deal with that? Yeah. Yeah. Suicide by cop. Yeah. Suicide by cop. It go. First we lost everything with that partition. Crossed the borders and the waters, they was on a mission. Parents got a range and moved to Queens in 1980. From the UP, it was loopy and the people treat them shady. It was crazy and they raised me, told me never to be lazy. As a baby, feeling guilty, stealing money for the hazy. Flushing, then in Glen Oaks, in the courtyard, play Saluji. In the fourth grade, I heard Biggie, caught the crawl, Kanai and Coogee. In the 10th grade, sat in class, saw the towers and the planes. And I never been the same, never ever been the same. Suicide by cop, suicide by cop. It's a slow suicide, then suicide by cop. Suicide by cop, suicide by cop. It's a slow suicide, then suicide by cop. Yeah. Yeah. Suicide by cop. Yeah. Yeah. It's a slow suicide, suicide by cop. A copper get shot if he drop up in that spot. Pop a lot of ox, box cutter Suri. Papa with an ox, bitch him FN Souza. Out in Aruba where she blow me like...
So in a way, you know, I kind of identify with Pakistan as well. Like, I'm not Muslim, I'm Hindu. I identify with Sikh. I'm Hindu and I'm Sikh. But at the same time, after 9/11, if people didn't see that difference in me, then I stopped seeing that difference in me. And another thing that I was vocal about was I'm sick of Hindus and Sikhs going out there and saying, why did they, you know, tag our temple? Why did they kill Sikhs? You know, we're not Muslim. I'm sick of the response being, we're not Muslim. You know, that response should be, even if we were Muslim, this shouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my grandparents are from modern day Pakistan, and at home I speak Urdu, and I grew up liking, you know, Muslim poetry. I grew up liking Muslim music, or Pakistani and Indian music, like Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan and things like that. Yeah, so that's partition.
Gonna pause for 1 second here. Sorry for the interruption, but we need to spread some love. If you like what you hear at Microphone Check, we recommend you give NPR's Fresh Air a try. That show got me through quite a few envelope-stuffing internships and was the occasion for the first time I met Jay-Z. He came through our office to do that interview when he was on his high-end publicity tour for Decoded. And if you haven't heard Terry Gross's 45 minutes with him, you should fix that. You can find Fresh Air at npr.org/podcasts.
When you mentioned that in Suicide by Cop, why?
Initially, it was just about the narrative of my life.
Yeah.
At first, we lost everything with that partition. Crossed the waters and the borders. We was on a mission. Parents got arranged and moved to Queens and moved to Queens from the UP. It was loopy, something like that. And the people treat them crazy as a baby, feeling guilty, stealing money for the hazy. It's just about my life. It's about, you know, hearing Biggie in the fourth grade. It's about my parents' marriage being arranged. And like I said, that narrative of starts with partition, then immigration, and then it gets to me. So just kind of my life story in that first verse. And then the second verse is just kind of cliche, like braggadocio rap, you know? Balance.
Let's not forget I Got Skills, a.k.a. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you got to do some of like the rappity rap rap. You know?
So my theory on 9/11 is that it mattered a lot more.
Is that it was an inside job, right? Me too, Mom.
The girls did it. Is that, like, if you had a way of understanding the world before it happened, and then it happened, your shit was just devastated. But if you're too so young that you didn't quite, like, understand or whatever, it somehow hasn't had quite as great an effect on you. You're still innocent in some way. So you were in 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know if I want to do this, honestly. like tell September 11th stories.
Yeah.
I don't really want to do it. I don't.
Let's not.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, cool.
I have a question.
Okay.
What is guala?
It means guap.
Oh, I thought that's an Indian, a Hindu word for, what is that?
Nah.
I never heard that term, guala.
I think I heard it from Lil Wayne first.
For real?
Yeah.
I was like,
It's Lil Wayne-ian.
But the word after that, I said guala wala. Wala in Hindi means person, like there's last names in Hindi, in India, like ice cream wala. That's a real last name. Or ganja wala. That's based on an occupation. So if he was the weed guy, then your last name is ganja wala. Or if he was the ice cream guy, your last name is ice cream wala. Moti wala, that's the diamond guy. So on the track, I say guala wala, like the money man.
Who are you speaking to in that song, Al-Qaeda?
I wasn't speaking. I mean, you know, you just get in the studio and rap. Like, I don't know if there's, I don't really think about an audience. And if I do, that audience is so diverse that I can't cater to one audience. My fans are, you know, I check off a lot of different boxes. I feel fortunate to be able to do so. So I don't really think about an audience when I get in there. But that song, you know, last time I was here, they basically asked me if I support terrorism. Because of that song, Al-Qaeda, because I say our guns from Al-Qaeda. That line is a reference to French Montana on Coke Wave. He said, you know, high hate is my guns from Al-Qaeda. If you look at Dipset calling themselves Taliban, you look at Joel Santana calling himself a young Muhammad Atta, you look at Left Rack, we grew up calling in that neighborhood Iraq, you know? So really it's about how, you know, rap, the black population here, the working class here, feels like, you know, not to bring it back to that, but when 9/11 happened and Mos Def said Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects, right? That song isn't me supporting terrorism. That song is me just saying that there are parallels to the way that we treat black people here and the way we treat brown people around the world. And it's not just me, but even the rap community has drawn those parallels before I was even rapping. That, you know, why did they call Left Rack Iraq? Or why is Chicago Chirac now? Like, because people on the ground even here, you know, feel some kind of affinity or some kind of, you know, feel like they could be compared to the people over there. And obviously a lot of people caught flack for things like young Muhammad Atta. Like, that's a crazy thing to say. But why would someone say that? You know, even if when you look at the book Reluctant Fundamentalist or the film, or when you look at Ayed Akhtar's Disgraced, both films, they talk about this moment where the brown protagonist, the Muslim protagonist, talks about almost a small feeling of pride when 9/11 happened. Like, I'm not saying that at all, but all I'm saying is that when you're an oppressed person, you find it easy to compare yourself to other oppressed people. And I'm just bringing up again that the way we treat black people in America is the way we treat other people of color around the world. And it's on a local level here is that, and on an imperial level, colonial level, there is that. But it's not about, obviously, like, I was traumatically affected by that event. I'm not praising anything like that. But, you know, all, like I said, Bin Laden, like Mos Def said, he didn't blow up the projects. So, I don't know. It is a confusing thing. Maybe it's controversial. I am a confused person, you know?
You don't really sound confused.
Really? Maybe I've been thinking about these things for a while, so
I mean, if you listen to, like, sometimes you may think you're a little unstable, but, you know, that's just if you were literal, and I don't take it to that. I understand artistic license and stuff like that, but I love everything that you're saying, because in hip-hop right now, no one's dropping history.
That was, it's not really history, but that new Kendrick song, Black of the Berry, that's amazing. I want to hear more stuff like that. No one's doing stuff like that anymore.
Yeah,
and now is when people need to do stuff like that.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, there's a lot of history.
Why now? Like, why do people need it now?
It's not now. It's always people need it. But if you look at specifically, like, police brutality in Ferguson and, you know, now would be a good time. But, you know, I talked about this the other week, too, just that, you know, when my label told me the Patriot Act is dated, that was, like, years ago. It's like, and I told them, it's not if you're me. It's not if you're a brown person. It's not if you're a person of color and they're tapping your phone. Like, every day you live with this. So maybe to you in your office as, like, a white man is dated. But to me, every day of my life, I deal with these things. So it's not now, and, you know, even if more people are paying attention to it now, then that's positive.
Well,
but it is history. It's not now. It's history. It's always been there. So if you need to remind people now, then do it.
Well, not to mention, to say that something like what Patriot Act really is in our law, in our structure, in how it governs our life, whether we know it to the depths of it or not, to even say that it's dated is a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, not that the corporations are in the market to,
yeah,
you know, pull the curtain back on these sort of things, but it affects everyone, and it's nothing good that comes from it.
You mean the fact that it's been around for so long, the problem, the fact that it's still enacted?
You know, think about, like, how many times on The Wire would they mention the Patriot Act as the reason they were able to use those wires to...
That FBI guy, yeah.
To lock up, like, you know, people in the hood in Baltimore. So the Patriot Act isn't just them spying on people that look like me. It's a, you know, like I said, they're using those tools to do what they do. And what they do is lock black men up in jail. That's what they do.
Policing the people, Babylon. Policing the people, policing the people, Babylon. Policing the people. Yeah. Product of partition, dripped in, product for the stitching, proud of superstitions. Got powder in the kitchen, powerful the kitten. Superpowers be killing America, Britain. Power for villains. Power for positions. Power for the pigeons. Powder for the shillings. Power for offshore drilling. Pirates plunder, pillage, killing civilians. Counting currencies, millions. Politics make victim for income. Parlor tricks, schism for system. Babylon policing the people. Take a man and they shift him. That Patriot Act, that's a privacy prison. That Pentagon, they vision is prison. Got what we asked for, someone to listen. Handcuffs, mother on phone. Jail cell, martyr who's stoned. Guard your home, neighbor with stones. Government drones, cookie cutter clones. Then the towers fell in front of my eyes. And I remember the principal said they wouldn't. And for a month they used my high school as a triage. And so we went to school in Brooklyn. And the city's board of ed hired shrinks for the students. And maybe I should have seen one. And from then on they called us all Osama. This old Sikh man on the bus was Osama. I was Osama, we were Osama. Are you Osama?
And so we rushed. Can we talk for a moment to your funny? I'm sorry, am I taking over?
No.
Can we talk to your funny side?
Sure.
You so New York, but you don't listen to Pac, but you rhyming over ATL beat. What's up with that, man?
Was it ATL beat?
It kind of sounds ATL-ish to me.
Harry Fraud is New York. Harry Fraud is Brooklyn. Harry Fraud is French Montana's producer. Like, and to me, the drums are Punjabi
yes,
to me. The
which
drums
I hear
almost
that.
Sound indie. This sounds
that.
Like Bhangra.
I hear that.
The
I hear that.
That's hip hop, but that's Bhangra too.
That's your loophole.
Maybe you know what sounded like Atlanta was Damn Girl. I sound a little Future on there. Or on Hubba Hubba, the way I go high beat, like you know, I say, what? Like that sounds maybe like Ray Sremmurd or something like that. So but how do you know, I didn't wanna so many people like were doing that. This is how I rap. Now. And then when Migos came out, it was, now I rap like this. And so how do you, you know, I wanted it to be New York and avoid that as much as I could. So
you know how I take it?
Yeah.
because I'm not even talking about, like, you know, your rhyme on top of it, your rhyme style. That, I appreciate it. But I was like, so New York, and I was just listening to it. I was like, and I definitely heard, you know, the Indian influence from the percussive aspect of it, but then the other aspect of it was just straight South to me.
You wanted like a skull snap and sample or something?
Not necessarily, but it just was funny to me, just the dynamic of the song being so New York, and I'm like, you know, New York, maybe it's the era.
Yeah, I was just thinking, maybe, you're landing, you know, 90s New York is different than now. Look at A$AP Rocky and those guys making Houston and Atlanta influence songs. But
that's what the funny, that's why the paradox of that song is so hilarious to me. I was like, oh, man.
Oh, I just remembered, someone just wrote that Fabolous made a song called So New York also, like a couple of years ago.
Which was one of my favorites.
Oh, so you didn't know that? We wrote about that in the first lesson.
Yeah, I didn't realize, I didn't think about that. But I love Fabolous.
Was it So New York or So Brooklyn?
It was NY.
It was so New York.
It was even so NY spelled like that. Yeah. I don't know. I tried to avoid Atlanta. I mean, musically. And I didn't even set out to make this New York album. But when you leave a place, you write about it. You know, if you look at, like, one of my favorite records is Paul's Boutique. Like, those guys were in L.A. when they were writing that album, which is considered to me like a quintessential New York record. Or when you look at, like, I always say the book Here Is New York was... E.B. White left, moved upstate, and then came back, and then wrote about New York. So, like, that perspective of leaving, you know, brings you home in a way, creatively. So, like, I didn't set out to make no New York record. And then
Here
I thought about
New
it.
New York is also the book where he predicts the
9/11.
Planes flying
where
into skyscrapers.
He talks about these buildings and
the
planes.
The big
birds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was definitely reading that around the time I was making the album.
Mm-hmm.
Bitch, I'm back, he me, and them women think I'm dreamy, and them fellas wanna be me, but neither of them can see me. I'm in my head, I'm dreaming for that next lick, I'm screaming for that next check, I'm screaming in your best bets, I'm leaning. Hubba, hubba, Pima, Abner Luima, I'ma do Diallo, I'm a new Diablo, this mile is stop bueno, not bad meaning bad. Yeah, I'm talking about that hash. La bit this, spin another hat spliff. Eat, pray, thug, it's like hat trick. Hat trick, it's madness. They calling him an addict, it's tragic. I'm the fucking man, now I don't have it. Dog food, I'm of another pedigree. Them critics just won't let me be. And I done lost the energy. Educating, set them free. They never been a friend of me. Friend of me, ahead of me, it's plain to see, take planes to see, I go and see the go and see, poetry, flowetry, the beat, like water, when I'm in a sea, it flow with me, young Walla Walla, young cocoa butter, tat her name across the grain, word Davina, that's my mother, he me, is that man, he follow through with plans, he follow up with fans. Follow up with fans, he swallow up the jam. They follow when he lands. Goddamn, goddamn, goddamn. Bitch, I'm back, pack the back. Couldn't flip no acrobat. Yeah, monkeys can sell bananas. Jack, that's a fact.
Well, let's talk about Gordon Voidwell.
Yeah, well, he might be going by Wills now, W-I-L-L-S.
Okay, for his fronted stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. He is from the Bronx.
He's from the Bronx, yeah.
He spent a lot of time in Minneapolis, though.
Now he's out in Minneapolis, yeah.
What did you think about his production?
I love it. Why else would I work with him?
No, I was asking Ali.
Oh, my bad.
I'm like, which song did he do?
Most of the rest.
Sometimes.
Oh,
he did.
Dope.
He did John Cage.
Sometimes. What did I think?
Yeah, because I thought that's when you talk about, like, the disco vibe.
He's got a disco funk.
But I like that, and especially, like, Sometimes being, is that the first song on the record? Mm-hmm. And so it sets it off. There's an aspect of it that, to me, is like a new hip-hop sort of, but it's not just hip-hop, it's something else. And then it wasn't really towards, like, the middle, towards the end of the record. It made me want to dance
Yeah, people have been saying that. Like,
it's a dance record, like, yeah, it but is. In yeah. a good way. Like, it's just like,
yeah.
You know, I love that. Like, when I started making music, I was a big fan of MIA, and mm-hmm. I love that she was talking about some serious stuff, but doing it on rap record, on dance records. And like I said, whether it's humor or whether it's dance music, they're just ways to package these serious topics of conversation in a way that, you know, people can accept it easier. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Voidwell makes, like, you know, funk and pop and disco influenced music, and you know, he's a big Prince fan. And
who did Home?
Dev Hynes, Blood Orange, and he came in the studio and was just like, we made that song in like 2 hours maybe. And he just came in, had the guitar line down, was like, yo, I got this kind of Indian sounding thing, and I was like, that does sound Indian, bro. That sounds like so 90s Bollywood to me. Then I have Rafiq Bhatia playing guitar on John Cage. Mm-hmm. So, and then I had Rostam from Vampire Weekend on one song playing guitar, but that song didn't get cleared. But I wanted guitars on the record. And yeah, I think, you know, I like dance music. Even earlier, That's Racist, we were working with Leaf and Diplo and these guys on production. And if you're talking about stuff that's so serious, it makes it a little easier to deal with when you could dance to it. He made Home. I mean, he made Pop Song. He made Damn Girl. He made Sometimes. And he made, John Cage.
So you went to Bomb. You said earlier that you were thinking about your relationship. What's up with the ladies? Are you confused when it comes to the relationship aspect? Because some of these songs, these relationships. Okay, before, I don't want to assume. It sounds sort of like Home was a relationship base, but I took it, at least the first verse, I was elsewhere with it. I took it as meaning literally the land and the dynamic in a relationship with the land. It wasn't until it got towards the end, I was like, oh, sound like
some girl stuff.
Some honey thing.
Some honey thing? Are you fucking kidding me?
Are you offended?
No. Couldn't be more supportive.
No, I wish it was this much smarter thing like you thought it was, where I was drawing parallels between, like, your relationship with a woman and Home.
But tell me about, like, you got a couple of songs.
I'm talking about on that song dependency in a relationship and codependency, and I'm talking about dependency with substances and, like, balancing those two dependencies. And then, obviously, throughout the whole record, there is this idea of, I don't know what my home is. I don't know whether it's here, whether it's there. But home is, you know, where the heart is. And if the heart is with a girl, that, like, it doesn't matter where I am. As long as I'm happy in that relationship, then I'll be happy. So there's a lot of moving pieces there. And that's why I said I'm confused, you know. And, you know, I guess the record tries to make sense of that confusion. But between, you know, mental health and substances, between breaking up with my ex, between That's Racist breaking up, between 9/11 and, you know, traveling the world and stuff, there's a lot of movement. Like, a fan last night on Twitter was like, I think this album was, like, important for you to you know, it seems like it was just as important for you to make it as it is for, like, us to hear it, or something like that, you know, just that you seem to have gotten a lot out of making this album. And I did. As far as things with the honeys, things are good. I'm just not trying to get into, like, a relationship, because I have too much on my plate, and I don't want to drag somebody into the mess that I am until I'm in a better place. So, like, I was celibate, like, 6 months this year, just to clear my head and not be, you know, off of everything, like, you know, because, like I said, that dependency can be with people, too. It doesn't always have to be bottle of wine or some drugs and something, like, you know. So yeah, that's where I am with the ladies.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I'd say I'm pretty happy. Now I'm back out there and dating and stuff. Now I'm back out there, so I'm happy now.
We'll be right back. is the sweaters that you left, the letters that I kept. That spoke of how you like when I kissed you on the neck and I held you as you wept. Yeah, I held you as we slept. I held you as we crept. I've been a mess since I met you. I regret you. You could say your love was regretful. You got me, I'll get you. If I could, I'd forget you. But I can't since I left you. I let you. If I could, I'd forget you. I would be more forgetful. When it's cold outside, yeah, I miss you. But we had too many issues.
Okay, how weird is that, though, to write something a year ago and, like, that's where you were a year ago, especially if you're, like, freestyling a fair amount of it, and now you have to talk about it and, like, explain it and remember what it's like.
Yeah,
that always seems like the craziest part about doing interviews.
Yeah, but that's, like, you know, the classic narrative of, like, a breakup thing, right? But then, like you just said, we don't want to talk about 9/11. That's what's more difficult, is doing these interviews where, like, I have to talk about the most traumatic event of my life. And like, I always get extremely anxious. My tone changes. I can't do it. So it's super hard. You make this thing as a therapeutic resource, and then to not have to talk about it. Like, I wanted to make this album so I could put these issues behind me and move forward with my life and the world. And then I ended up having to wait 15 months. Well, like, you know, do I give up on music? Do I get a job? I work right now at an advertising technology company 4 days a week on top of managing myself, directing the music video I just did with Eric Andre and Hannibal Buress, and, you know, dealing with the label, making my own marketing plan. I'm the A&R on my album at the label. And, yeah, it's just, like, a whole lot of stuff. And so last year was... It's not just now it's frustrating to talk about all those things I was going through, but it was more frustrating to wait to talk about those things. Like, I knew I had to talk about them, but it was more like I would have rather done that than when it. And yeah, obviously, like, you know, my ex hit me up today after listening to it and was a little upset. So it's tough to, you know, that I have to get back into that and talk to her, and just I'm getting back dragged into that, like, relationship or talking about it or dealing with it after it's been over for like 2 years. So it's extremely difficult, but that's what you do. You're an artist. You make things, you put that out there. And just as difficult as it is, when that reciprocated energy comes back to me in the form of a fan telling me it's helped them get through something, then it makes it easier to go through it. You know, it's about putting that energy out there and then seeing what comes back, I think. Whether it's, like, on a stage at a show, or whether it's with the album, or whether it's, you know, the art show I just did in NoHo, or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah. Well, definitely appreciate the energy you put out there. I think it...
Thank you, Ali Shaheed Mom.
Needed to. Who am I? But yeah, it definitely needed to be said, and... The best thing about art is when you definitely feel something, even if, you know, if you're feeling elated or joy, anger, enraged, like, obviously that's a good piece of art. And so it's great.
Wow, thank you, man. I agree that the purpose of art shouldn't be to make you feel something, anything. So when somebody has been telling me, like, yo, the end of that album, yo, that was crazy, like, it's cool to me because it almost feels like they're talking about a movie or a book, like, mm-hmm. There's a plot and a narrative, and then at the end, you know? So when they talk about Patriot Act like that, or just like I said, when a lot of, like, the Muslim or Indian kids have been hitting me up, like, yo, Flag Shopping and Patriot Act spoke to me like that.
But it's just the MC skills are sharp, so it's just flamboyant. You know, and you should be, like, on Def Jam, because, well, at least the old Def Jam. I'm not taking shots. I'm just saying, you know, my relationship with Def Jam, I always, perfect example, Tribe Called Quest was in a bidding war. We did, and Def Jam was in that bidding war. We went to Jive, and I looked over the years, and I'm like, we certainly was not a Def Jam artist. Mm. You know, like, Def Jam artists, like, really just...
So you're thinking more like Public Enemy era? 89,
right?
Well, I mean, 89, a lot that came after that. Like,
you're like LL.
LL, DMX, like, you know, just really flamboyant, just like, you know, getting your face kind of popping that thing sort of. And that wasn't, well, we didn't represent that, but I feel like in your delivery, your skills are definitely wow. New York sharp.
Thank you, man. That means a lot to me. I don't think I could really convey that, but that means a lot to me from you. Thank you.
How do you deal with, like, because you're kind of saying, like, you're a part of hip-hop, but you're off to
right,
the
well,
side
I mean, you
of...
know, people used to hit me with that joke rap label, that hipster rap label, that...
Yeah, whatever. I don't care about that. I mean, but, like, how do you deal with, like, the legends, like, talking to you? Like, you tweeted something, you're doing something with Easy Mo B and Big Daddy Kane?
Oh, no, I did some radio show interview, and they were other guests on the show.
And they weren't in the same room?
No. Okay. How do I deal with, like... But, I mean, whether it's, like, a lot of, like... Yeah, rappers or even like Salman Rushdie has become like a friend of mine. I mean, that's the most rewarding thing is when another artist appreciates you or validates you in a way. I mean, you don't want to be seeking validation from nobody because at the end of the day, you're a man, you're making your work, you're putting it out there. But when somebody else who you know has been through the motions, who's dealt with this industry or dealt with the vulnerability of putting yourself out there in such a big way, you know, tells you that they appreciate what you do, and it's a mutual feeling. That's the best part. That's the organic, creative energy of rap. It's like, yo, I want to work with you. I want to collaborate with you. Not because the label's telling me, not because I got an album coming out, but because rap is collaborative, and because like I dig your energy, and like let's get in the studio and see what we make. You know, but that, and then you know, eventually it becomes again like label politics, this or that. But the organic raw. Collaborative energy of hip hop is what makes it so cool.
I mean, to me, there's like a romantic element to it, to like these guys that were like so fucking huge and like mattered so much to me.
When I said one of my favorite New York rappers from the 90s snuffed me like 2 years ago.
What?
Yeah. And I came, I'm not gonna say who, whatever, but I was like, hey, I'm a really big fan. And the whole night, I just felt a lot of negative energy from dude. And then, you know, what he said was at the end of the night, I popped off at him like I called him like a has-been or something, which might, you know, I did. But, yeah, then I got sucker punched and dude ran away. And you know, I'm not a big fighter. He probably would have, you know, I don't even think he needed to sucker punch me. He could have just punched me, but... Yeah, that is crazy because, yeah, I'm, I guess, a new rapper, but I'm an older dude, too. I'm not, like, 23 out here, so I grew up liking a lot of that old rap. I'm not out here being like, oh, man, F these old heads, you know, that's not what I like. Like, I feel like I was at that ending cusp of that generation of rap, and, you know, but at the same time, I'm part of this tech Twitter ADD world of rap too, and the same way I feel like I was there before the internet, and I remember what life was like then, and I remember when the internet came, and now I know life after the internet. So that timing of like my life of everything is very much old and new worlds, but yeah, I mean I'm always excited when someone I like digs my work, but yeah, like I said, I'm not going through life looking for those accolades. It's not about that. It's more important to me when I could help a young person. Yeah. And, you know, rap is weird, man. It's collaborative, but there's also competition, your own friends and stuff. You're super competitive with your own homies. And, you know, when you're on the come up, everybody will work together. But then when you're, like, you know, out there and stuff. Like, 2012, I had Childish Gambino, Danny Brown, and Action Bronson on my mixtape and stuff. And on this one, I didn't want to be, like, working with other rappers. There's not a single other rapper on here because I wanted it to be a showcase of me, and I didn't want to be riding nobody else's wave. I wanted this one to be my wave, you know?
Mm-hmm. as you get like more attention and whatever, and we talk on the record a lot about protecting your parents, like help like helping them communicate and whatever. As you become more of a name, does that become like a bigger burden? And have you ever had to deal with that, like protecting your family from your success or your notoriety or something like that?
Have you, Ali?
Mm-hmm.
It's a crazy, you know, when I look at rap right now, right? J. Cole's got a record out where he's talking about running around New York and, you know, doing his rapper thing. Meanwhile, at home, his mom's getting foreclosed on the crib. Drake dropped the song You and the Six, where he's talking about, you know, thank God Toronto and my mom raised me. Otherwise, like, I wouldn't be prepared to handle this world. Action Bronson dropped the joint Acting Crazy. Like, you know, mom, still your little baby. Why you think I'm out here acting crazy? And a lot of these songs, they're feeling guilty about running around the world. They're talking about coming home to their parents. They're talking about, you know, being glad that their moms raised them that way, or that everything they're doing, you know, it might not seem apparent to you, mom, but the reason I'm out here acting crazy is for you. And I feel like I could relate to that. And, you know, that's basically my favorite genre of rap right now is, like, I'm sorry, mom, rap. Or, like, you know, don't look at that price tag, mom. Like, you know, that's a real moment where, like, you know, my parents still cutting coupons and stuff, and I'm spending $1,000 on a scarf. I feel terrible guilt about stuff like that, but I still stunt. But, yeah, I mean, you know, and it's hard, especially, how do you explain, you know, being in magazines or on TV or the attention you get to people and then that you're still the same person? Like, your parents are always going to treat you like the way they treat you. They don't care what magazine you in or nothing. Take that trash out, boy, you know? And, like, so I take that trash out. And that's what it's about. They keep you grounded, too. Like, that's why I like living at home right now, because my head would be way too big if I wasn't. That's why I like working in advertising per hour and doing data entry, because otherwise one check for 1 hour performance makes me feel like I'm on top of the world. But you got to realize the value of money. And, yeah, and I think it's a particularly immigrant thing to want to take care of your parents. Or, you know, it's not so much about communication. I would be so pissed off when I was like 7 and some guy at the store would talk to me instead of my mom's or dad, and they spoke to them in English, but they, you know, because of an accent or whatever, they would talk to me, and I'd be like, Mom, I'm 7 years old, talk to my parents, idiot. Why are you talking to me? I'm a kid, you know? So when you grow up with that type of thing, you know, or just when an Indian man in Alabama is there to visit his son and grandchild and gets, you know, paralyzed by the police, you start worrying about your dad on that train or your dad out there with the police. The same way my parents worry about their son going outside and police harassing them is the same way I worry about my parents going outside and the police harassing them. And, you know, like I tweeted once, like, do white people have this urge to buy their parents' property that, like, I have, that all, you know, that my boys in the neighborhood have? Like, you know, I want to buy my mom's a house. Like, that's the number one thing I want to do. Or is that not, you know, in that world? Because it feels like such a normal part of my life. Or, you know, I'm the eldest son of the family. I help with the bills at home, you know, and I want to, yeah. And my parents helped put me through school, too. So it's the least I can do for everything they've done.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, how did your parents take you becoming a rap star?
My mom made me write an essay when I wanted to leave college to record. And so she's always been supportive, brought my turntables when I was crazy young. But in terms of protecting, I'm still always protective of my family. I don't, in the social media, like, you'll never see any pictures and photos of me and my family. Because to me, like, that is my sanctity. And I think you need something away from the public, mm-hmm. you know, not that it's crazy. It's not like my life is like Justin Bieber or something like that. But just for me, there's an aspect that I need to go to. And so for me, it's my family. And my mom is just, she's proud. She doesn't speak about it. My grandma, that's different. I just took her to the doctor a couple of days ago, and she's just like, yeah, my grandson. Mm-hmm. I'm like, and I don't say anything. I'm like, that's her shining moment. You know, like, she knows that I'm just super low key, but I'm like, that's grandma. Like, cool. Yeah, that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Can we help her, though? You know? Mm-hmm. So that's how I deal with it. But I've always been grounded, and so it's my mom's as cool as, and I think as calm as I am about a lot of things. My mom is probably even more calm and chill about things. So I get it from my mama.
My mom is very worried that I'm gonna like write a book and tell all her secrets, or like just like accuse her of some wild shit. And I always like, I think about that when people like talk about their families and talk about their or like, yeah, pictures. And you know, I have friends that get known, and then like people ask them these crazy questions, and like
I'm so out there with my family on Instagram because I hang out at home. I play with my nieces. That's what I do. So I'm not gonna, I don't want to put out this curated, you know, idea of what my life is, that I'm only out hanging out with celebrities and playing shows. No, the most important thing in my life is family. So and I feel like a lot of like Indian kids relate to that. So I think, and you know, a lot of the other creatives who are South Asian aren't really growing up in a community with like 17 of their cousins, or aren't growing up with like their grandma and their and them, and you know, are so I don't know. For me to be a creative, I want other people to know that I'm really, I don't know, in a sense, I'm like, yo, I'm really Indian. I really speak Hindi at home and like eat this food every day, and I'm not like some, you know, fancy like son of professors or nothing like that. But then it's a delicate thing because I'm not trying to look for my street cred or validation through my parents' struggles. So my parents will be like, don't talk about your dad driving a cab, or, you know, don't talk about me working at Pathmark. What are you doing? Why would you put that out there? You know, and I get where they're coming from too. And so, yeah, it's super, you know, tough thing when you, you know, the Village Voice just asked me what my parents' names and occupations are and whether they could get a statement from my parents on my career. And I'm just like, nope, no way. That's how I'll protect them. It's not about their image or nothing, but it's about, no, you don't talk to my parents, no. I mean, even my parents have been to maybe two of my concerts out of like 300 because, I mean, they don't, they just, they believe in me. They know I'm doing well, but they don't need to be there for like every step of the way, you know?
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so thank you.
Thank you, Franny. Sorry I had to cancel on Friday.
Whatever. Now I'm sick.
It worked out much better.
It worked out because, I don't think I was going to be here. That wasn't part of the plan.
Are you DJing at all while you're in town?
No. I'm just sneaking in. I haven't even, I was like
you can
before,
find him at Choice later.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like when I left LA, I was like, picture of the sun shining, because I know I was going to Cold Brick Chicago, and I was like, I said something about that, and I don't even post stuff often, and then got to Chicago, I was like, now look at that, and I was like, I want to say, like, I'm going home, and I was like, nope, I can't do that. Like, I,
cause you gotta keep it tight.
I gotta keep it tight, because I'm about to get, just like, oh, man. So, but I am happy that this worked out this way.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you guys for having me. I'm officially be checking the podcast out. Is it a podcast or is it on NPR? Podcast.
It's not on a radio.
Yeah, it's on NPR.com.
Mm-hmm, and it's on iTunes and whatever, and SoundCloud.
Great. Well, I'm going to be checking out the next ones too.
Thank you.